Welcome to Anti-Capitalist Radio. This special edition features US-based activist Michael Sturzer, who recently spoke at a meeting hosted by Anti-Capitalist Resistance London about his book The London Revolution, 1640-1643, Class Struggles in 17th Century England. His book is available from the Mad Duck Coalition Publishing House at themadduckcoalition.org. As ever, please also head over to Anti-Capitalist Resistance website for all the latest revolutionary socialist news, analysis and theory, especially around the ongoing conflict in Gaza and the fight for Palestinian national rights. You can visit our website at anticapitalistresistance.org. But now I will hand over to Susan Pashkov from the ACR organising group, who introduced Michael at the London meeting.
Michael Sturzer is a native New Yorker who grew up in Brooklyn. And he learned about radical politics from his father, who had been active in the labor movement of the 1930s. In 1966, at the age of 14, he attended his first mass anti-Vietnam War rally with other students from his high school. In college, while actively involved in working class struggles, he studied Marxism and in 1974, graduated cum laude from the State University of New York at Buffalo. In the following decades, while continuing to study Marxism and the history of labor and liberation movements, he remained a labor activist. As a member of the Communication Workers of America, that's the CWA, in the early 1980s, and that was one wonderful strike, he raised money from co-workers for the defense and militant phone workers who were arrested on the picket line during a West Coast strike. Throughout the 80s and 90s, Michael also helped mobilize workers and minorities against Klan and Nazi terror in major cities across the country, demonstrating that the integrated labor movement was the main force that could defend all their intended victims. In line with a long history of defending those persecuted by the capitalist injustice system, his motion demanding freedom for framed up journalist and former Black Panther, Mumia Abu-Jamal, then on death row, was passed in 2006 by his local union in the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. In 2013, he organized a petition of support from AFSCME, co-workers for Lynn Stewart, an imprisoned leftist lawyer suffering from stage 4 cancer. After a nearly year-long campaign, she finally won early release. Sturzer continues to live, study, and write in New York City. Since his retirement in 2014, he has traveled a good deal, including a 9-week trip to London, York, Edinburgh, and Dublin. Among the places he enjoyed visiting were the Cromwell Museum in Huntington and the National Civil War Center in Newark. The trip reinforced his belief in the social nature of the English Revolution. It was a revisionist historian's attempts to excise the class basis of the English Revolution and Civil War that led him to the studies detailed in his work. Again, we'd like to thank Michael for contacting us, and we're really privileged to have him do his talk. And I give you Michael.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you all for coming. My presentation tonight is going to be fairly short, and I apologize for that. But as she mentioned, I had COVID not too long ago, and I'm not yet completely restored. I encourage your questions and comments during the discussion. This is actually the first time I'm presenting to a mainly British audience. I doubt you need an American to tell you about things like Magna Carta or the King's attempt to arrest the 5 members, so I'm only going to mention a couple of lesser-known events from the narrative here. Marx, of course, considered England the classic example of capitalist development, and by 1600, England was an economically capitalist country. Thus, the central contradiction of 17th century England was between a nascent capitalist economy constrained by a feudal political and social system. I wrote the book to defend and restate the Marxist view against the right-wing revisionist historians, who had gone to great lengths to write revolution out of English history. We owe an immense debt to the historian Christopher Hill, who almost single-handedly established the understanding of the English Revolution as a fundamentally social and not merely a religious or Puritan revolution. This had been the conventional wisdom for the preceding century or so. His Marxist perspective on the English events became the one that all others had to reckon with in the mid-20th century. The reactionary revisionist historians vehemently attacked Hill even before, and certainly after, Maggie Thatcher's election, for attempting to make the English Revolution conform to the model of the Russian Revolution of 1917. In one particular way, which they neither understood nor appreciated, they were right. Hill had joined the Communist Party just as the Stalinized Communist International was entering its popular front period. This entailed a hell-bent pursuit for a political alliance with liberal bourgeois politicians who were dubbed progressive. Hill ascribed the same virtues to what he called the progressive gentry in the 17th century. Now, there was some good reason for Hill to do this. Much of the landowning gentry, as represented by the MPs in the House of Commons, certainly were progressive for their day, which is a great deal more than can be said for the likes of Franklin Roosevelt and Neville Chamberlain in the 1930s. But contrary to Hill's colleague R.H. Tawney, the gentry were not simply bourgeois. They were junior partners in the feudal ruling class, political moderates who wanted to reform the existing feudal system, not subjective revolutionaries. Hill, who had left the CP in 1957, was eventually forced to concede that there was no revolutionary party in the House of Commons. Unfortunately, in attempting to salvage a revolutionary understanding of the Civil War and its aftermath, he introduced some further distortions to an orthodox Marxist analysis. None of this, however, calls into question his enormous contributions in advancing our understanding of the revolutionary decades. In promoting the Marxist view of the English Revolution and the Civil War as a conflict between social classes, Hill was following Marx and Engels, and also Leon Trotsky, though he would have been loath to admit to him. He was hardly unaware of the radically Puritan, petty bourgeois middling class of artisan craft workers, small shopkeepers, domestic traders, and mariners, who were the sans-culottes of their day. But he wrote very little about them. It was the middling citizens' movement in London, arms in hand, led by Puritan clergy and radically independent, free-trading Atlantic merchants, who provided the horsepower for the revolution, and thereby gave force to the decisions of the House of Commons gentry in its struggle against the king. Without the support of the armed masses in the streets, the gentry did not have the power to overcome the king and lords. At the same time, the religious persecution of the 1630s caused more radically separatist gathered churches to spread, and opposition to a monopoly on religion paralleled opposition to monopolies on trade and production. The interests of the liberal gentry, bourgeois Atlantic merchants, and petty bourgeois middling people were therefore closely aligned. The Puritans' political demand for abolition of episcopacy, root and branch, was revolutionary. The fall of the church would mean the fall of the monarchy. But the outcomes each of the various classes wanted were rather different. These differences, however, were suppressed, often deliberately, within the general Puritan movement during the fight in London against the king. Only once the king had fled his capital did they begin to emerge. The middling class was thus kept politically subservient to the Atlantic merchants' political alliance with the gentry, regardless of how much pressure they brought to bear on them. The new London government, headed by the independent Puritan merchant Isaac Pennington, failed to mobilize the masses against the royalists, to fully mobilize the masses against the royalists, as many of the most radical street-level activists wanted to do. This demoralized their followers and left the way open for counter-revolution. A crisis occurred in the summer of 1643, when all three of Parliament's armies suffered serious defeats. This was the fault of the House of Commons, which was politically divided over the war. The military crisis brought the political crisis to a head in London and Westminster, and the House of Commons came within a handful of votes of surrendering to the king. It was the only occasion since taking power in January 1642 that the Puritan London leaders mobilized their followers for a demonstration at Parliament. By the end of 1643, however, reaction had taken over the city government. Pennington was replaced as Lord Mayor by a moderate. Independents were purged from city offices, and the war effort was consolidated under the Commons gentry. I want to talk a little bit about how the English Revolution relates to today. Any mass social struggle that is not thoroughly victorious will sooner or later face the possibility of reversal. The eventual betrayal of the middling people's interests in London was set up, and the surrounding areas, was set up by the class collaboration between the bourgeois London leadership and the Commons gentry. The lesson here is the absolute necessity for complete political and organizational independence of the revolutionary class from its rulers. Their political alliance, incidentally, not only accounts for the gentry's leadership of the Civil War, but for the continued existence of the British monarchy today. Ludicrous as it is, but just as reactionary. The different political programs reflecting these different class interests would not be fully fought out until the period of 1647 to 49, after the king's military defeat, with the purge of Parliament, the king's execution, the establishment of the Commonwealth under the Rump, and the defeat of the Levellers. A century ago now, Trotsky wrote that the Levellers were, quote, the incipient party of the left wing of the petty bourgeoisie who had become the most important force of the revolution. The Levellers' defeat was caused by a number of political factors, including their own mistakes. But their motivation, courage, resourcefulness, and dedication were not the problem. In their propaganda and agitation, they publicly pitted themselves and their program against the king and lords, the Presbyterian MPs and city officials, and at times the army grandees, who were betraying the goals and gains of the revolution as they understood them. Although I don't know of any mention he ever made of the Levellers in his writings, these are qualities Lenin would have admired. Their defeat undermined the revolution, and it left the new capitalist republic with a very narrow base of support. Cromwell's protectorate represented the Bonapartist degeneration of the revolution, but while it lasted, it was a bulwark against reactionary royalism. Even the restoration of Charles II did not simply put everything back the way it had been. Far too much had happened and changed. The bourgeois revolution, building on the mid-century events, was completed in its essentials in 1688 to 89, despite the hybrid power-sharing arrangement with the aristocracy. The struggles of the Levellers point to the key element of revolutionary leadership. To be successful, it is necessary to oppose not only the class enemy, but equally the sellouts and betrayers of the revolutionary class. This was the first of the 21 conditions issued by the early Comintern. In the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels wrote that the only difference between the communists and the mass of proletarians was that they could clearly see the road ahead. But that knowledge is of little use if it is not sharply fought for. As in 1643 London, anything less only guarantees setbacks and defeats. The vanguard must be the general staff of the revolution that ensures the fight is carried out to a decisive victory, as Cromwell, the military leader, understood. I want to say a word about Marxist analysis here. Historical materialism, the method of Marxism, embodies the understanding of contradiction. The muddy dispute over the gentry question in the 1950s was largely irrelevant. What was lacking on all sides was an appreciation of the contradictory social position of the gentry at the time, as landowners who participated, to one degree or another, in the capitalist money economy. They had a foot in each of two different social systems, feudalism and capitalism. As I explain in the book, quote, "The more the government of Charles I attempted to centralize power, the more of a hindrance it was to the expansion of capitalist ventures. The more the improving gentry insisted on doing as they liked with their own property, the more they resisted that centralization." Bourgeois democratic rights to individual freedom, but above all to property and profit, is the inheritance we received from the English Revolution. Property has long since trumped any political rights of the individual for the capitalist classes today, though they continue to pretend otherwise. In the 17th century, capitalism was progressive. By the end of the 19th, it no longer was. Rosa Luxemburg, following Marx and Engels, wrote that the alternatives facing humanity were socialism or barbarism. It seems obvious that today we are moving at a pretty rapid clip towards barbarism. Whatever form barbarism takes, a new world war, fascism, economic or environmental collapse, the root cause is the capitalist profit system. Only the intervention of the working class under revolutionary leadership can change that trajectory. The English Revolution serves as an example, both positive and negative, of how an outmoded social system can and must be replaced. In restoring the revolutionary origins of capitalism and bourgeois political power, my book is also an attempt to indicate the appropriate historical lessons. The democratic rights the bourgeoisie has gutted must be defended by Marxists as part of the fight for new revolutions that will put an end to the profit system once and for all.